I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
A jury in New York has found the leader of a self-help group guilty of 7 counts of sex trafficking and racketeering. Keith Raniere attracted some high-profile followers to his group Nexium, including actresses and one of the heirs to the Seagram's fortune. But prosecutors say the group was more like a cult that had a secret society of sex slaves. Some former recruits testified they were coerced into having sex with Raniere. They were also kept on starvation diets and even branded with his initials. Raniere was revered by the group as the smartest man in the world.
On this edition of Parallax Views. The brief news clip you just heard summarizes, in an admittedly highly condensed manner, the disturbing story of Nexium and its founder, Keith Raniere. Operating ostensibly as a multi-level marketing organization headquartered in Albany, New York, Nexium peddled in the lucrative business of self-help through what it called executive success programs. The organization garnered a number of high-profile members and associates, including Kristen Kruick and, more infamously, Allison Mack, who served as two of the main cast members on the hit Superman TV series Smallville. Battlestar Galactica actress Nikki Klein. Emiliano Salinas, a venture capitalist and son of former Mexican president Carlos Salinas de Gortari. Mark Vicente, the filmmaker behind the popular spiritual documentary What the Bleep Do We Know? And Sarah and Claire Bronfman, the wealthy heiresses to the Seagram's liquor fortune, among others. Despite such seemingly respectable associations and memberships, many accused Nexium of being akin to a pyramid scheme and, most notoriously, a cult acting in the fanatically devoted service of its Svengali-like guru founder, Keith Raniere, otherwise known within Nexium's inner circles as Vanguard. In March 2018, those allegations came to the fore with the arrest of Raniere on multiple charges. The harrowing story of Nexium conjures nightmarish images of the Manson family and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The difference, however, is that Nexium didn't function in a world of isolated social misfits and outcasts, but rather within the confines of respectable society, even as its dark underbelly was hiding right beneath said society's nose. Ranieri and other members, including the aforementioned Allison Mack, faced charges ranging from racketeering and forced labor to sex trafficking and possession of child pornography. Former associates and members told their stories. The previously mentioned Mark Vicenti famously had an emotional meltdown in court, describing Nexium in no uncertain terms as evil. Survivors gave chilling accounts of forced isolation, starvation diets, human branding, and sexual slavery. By the end of the trial, Ranieri was found guilty on all charges, and other members, such as Allison Mack, Claire Bronfman, and Ranieri's number two in command, Nancy Salzman, went down with him. In that courtroom sat a woman who knew Ranieri all too well. She was there to bear witness to the trial of a man who she'd not seen or spoken to in years. A man who called himself Vanguard and made a promise to her years prior that the next time they met, she'd either be in prison or dead. Her name was Toni Natali, the ex-girlfriend of Keith Ranieri, who has been described as his patient zero, on whom Nexium's techniques of psychological terrorism would first be put to use. On this edition of Parallax Views, Toni Natali, alongside Chet Hardin, one of the primary journalists to cover the Nexium case, join us to discuss her story and their new book, The Program: Inside the Mind of Keith Ranieri and the Rise and Fall of Nexium. You've read the sensational headlines and heard the salacious soundbites about the Hollywood sex cult, but none of that can do justice to the true harrowing story of Nexium and its diabolical mastermind, Keith Ranieri. And now, with that being said, my conversation with Toni Natali and Chet Hardin on their book, The Program: Inside the Mind of Keith Ranieri and the Rise and Fall of Nexium. Welcome to Parallax Views, Toni Natali and Chet Hardin, authors of The Program: Inside the Mind of Keith Ranieri and the Rise and Fall of Nexium. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing well. Thank you so much for having us on your show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sergi.
So it's kind of hard to figure out where to start talking about Nexium, because there's so many of the stories that we hear about Nexium sort of have this, tabloid sensationalism around it, you know, the Hollywood sex cult. But of course, Toni, you had a romantic relationship at one point with Ranieri. And Chet, you've been covering this, for a long time, the story of Nexium. And I think the sort of Hollywood sex cult headlines don't do justice to how disturbing this story is. Chet, would you like to maybe fill us in on how you became interested in this story? And then we can get into Tony's sort of experiences.
Sure. I had just started a job at the Alternative News Weekly in Albany. I think I'd been there for a month when I got contacted by a former contractor with Nexium, and he wanted to get some attention for the organization. He said it was cult-like. He didn't call it a cult, but he said it was cult-like. And he provided me with some background. He provided me with some documentation. Then he put me in contact with Tony. And like I said, it was probably the third or fourth story that I did for this alternative news weekly called Metroland. It's defunct now. And that was back in 2006. And at the time, there wasn't much reporting about Nexium. There was the Forbes article, which is a now famous article. There were a few articles by the Times Union, the local daily paper. Some of the outlier daily newspapers had done a couple stories, but for the most part, Nexium was unreported about, and Keith Ranieri was not really. Hadn't really been investigated, so it was sort of open territory for me, and it was very exciting to be given that this story that was kind of essentially mine for a while. I could call it my own story, my own sort of cult, investigation. So that's how I got involved.
And real quick, do you think that there's any truth to what I said there about I think there's much more to the Nexium story than sort of when you bring up Nexium to the average person, if they know about it, they'll say, oh, the Hollywood sex cult. I don't think that does justice to how sort of terrifying this whole story is. I don't know if both of you want to comment on that.
Well, I think you're right about that. It's what brought attention finally to Nexium was the level of, the celebrity that Keith desired and brought into the cult. But so that was part of their undoing. But no, calling it a Hollywood sex cult has little to nothing to do with the actual what is actually disturbing about Nexium and Keith Ranieri, and what is actually worth studying about Nexium and Keith Ranieri.
Tony, do you have anything to sort of add to that? What how would you maybe sum up Nexium?
Nexium is the brainchild of a madman. I mean, Keith has been he's been experimenting and trying over and over in different ways to perfect his art of manipulation with people. And anyone that has been involved with him on any level knows that it starts off very, very slow. It's a very slow drip. And he is brilliant in one respect of his sleight of hands. Things happen and you're not even aware that they've happened until you're so fully enthralled that you're kind of looking up going, how the hell did I get here?
How did you first come in contact with Keith Ranieri? What was that experience, and how did you sort of get involved with his initial project, Consumers Byline Incorporated?
Yes. The thing that I like to point out with people is we are so accustomed today to having our life in the palm of our hand. We have our phones that are literally small computers. So if someone asks a question in reference to someone, or someone makes a statement, a lot of people Google things now. so that they have a little more heads up on what's really going on. When I met Keith Raniere in 91, there was no internet, not in the way that the public was had access to it. So Consumers Byline was a membership-based organization. It was my opinion, a brilliant concept of saving consumers goods and services and quite a bit of money if used properly when they used the membership. The problem with the company wasn't so much what it was selling, it was the person selling it. It was Keith's need to manipulate and control the multi-level marketing side of it that caused the problems. And I got involved with him as first a member of Consumers Byline, and then he gave me a job running one of the divisions. It was a subsidiary of Consumers Byline called Awaken. It was a skincare line. And he was, the multi-level marketing side of things was very important to Keith, always was. He was an Amway salesman. So that's where his fascination with MLM came from. So at the time, New Skin was a very popular multi-level marketing company, and he was trying to draw on that side of the consumers using that type of product. So they created a product called Awaken, which was a skincare line. And I came to Clifton Park to run that division of the company for him.
How did you become, you start out sort of as in business together, but a sort of relationship comes out of that. I don't know if you'd be open to talking a little bit about how sort of Keith ingratiated himself more deeply into your life.
Sure. I go into a lot of the details in the book, but the reality is he's very patient and very slow and very methodical in the way that he draws things out of you. So you really believe that you're sharing some information or personal things with a friend. And because of the way that he was presented, I mean, he was the smartest man in the world with a 240 IQ and a triple major graduate and a top problem solver. And the people around him supported that. Some of those people, the people that helped to perpetuate that lie, were still there when he was arrested, in this last round. So to digress for a bit, the only way that Keith is able to do what he did then and now and when he moved forward was he needed enablers. He needed people there to be able to support his lies. And that is, when we would have our discussions and we would talk about business and personal things, the people around him seem so. And you had the daughter of a wealthy family from Washington, D.C., actually one of the wealthiest families in D.C. And you had people with very strong accolades, very strong connections, and you believed what they said. So you moved through the process of getting involved with him in a slow, methodical manner. But I think he knew from the beginning what he expected, at least from me, and what, as time went on, he expected and needed from other people.
Two things on that note. First, the IQ thing. As far as I can tell, he sort of was confabulating a little bit about that 240 IQ. And also, I think another thing that I get from this book, the program, is that, he ingratiated himself by, being a good listener and acting very caring, and sort of not taking the mask off until it was too late. Maybe you could comment on those two things, Tony, real quick.
Well, yes. When the Eastern District of New York came out with their indictments, and they pulled, as you say, the mask off the man, showing that he was barely passing his grades. Had that come out even in 2012 when the Albany Times Union did that amazing three-part series, I think it would have had a great impact on his ability to draw people in. It was absolutely his calling card. Smartest man in the world with a 240 IQ. So that pull people into the mix. And what was the second part of your question?
Well, it seems like the way he preyed on people, especially women, was to sort of say, like, I'm going to listen to you. And he sounds like he was a good listener, that he would act very caring initially. But then if you crossed him, it was, you know, the rage of, you know, a devil almost.
Well, yes. I mean, when I met him, the persona that he was using, and he's changed, he's morphed as he's needed to through his lifetime, was that of a businessman. And then he moved into, you know, a dutiful boyfriend helping me to raise my child and running a health food business. And when that wasn't enough for him, he found his next best with Nancy Salzman, who at the time was, as she claimed to be, the number two NLP expert, neuro-linguistic programming, for people in your audience that aren't familiar with that, in the world. And it's a form of hypnotherapy. And Nancy was amazing at taking a select group of people and being able to manipulate them into a state that was, she was able to control them. And when Keith saw that, the first time he saw her do a workshop, he knew that was his next move. That's where he was going. He was not being idolized the way he wanted to in selling vitamins in a health food store. It was not what he had intended for his life.
Well, Chad, I want to kick it over to you, maybe to talk about what Nexium was beyond this image of the Hollywood sex cult, because there's also a lot of financial chicanery that is involved in this story, going all the way back to Consumer Byline Incorporated. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the sort of financial shenanigans that were going on with Nexium.
Well, I don't know how much we can go into the financial shenanigans, other than, you know, we could talk about this exploitation of members of Nexium, you know, these classes that were set up essentially to keep people coming back, to keep people recruiting for Nexium. So you had an organization that met the definitions of a pyramid scheme, and they would draw people in, and they would continuously gouge them for class fees, and they would part of the Nexium organization was to recruit friends and family to be able to get higher levels, to achieve higher levels within the Nexium organization. But the structure of Nexium was set up in such a way as to amass as much wealth for Keith, or for Keith's control, because as Tony says, money never really seemed to be Keith's motivator. Money was always just a way to, the money was always there to enable a lifestyle that Keith wanted, which was a lifestyle of seclusion. He had a lifestyle where he was able to do essentially whatever he wanted. And the money was also there to trap people within this organization. So the financial side of Nexium was to create this community, the community that Keith wanted. And if he couldn't get it from what he couldn't get from class, the money brought him to classes, he was able to get from people like Pamela Kayfritz, who was his first financial enabler. He was able to get it from the wealthy heiresses, Sarah and Claire Bronfman. Claire is one of his convicted co-conspirators. Sarah was not, but they were both financial enablers, and they had access to hundreds of millions of dollars, and that was able to keep keep the lifestyle that Keith was accustomed to. So certainly there was other, as you put, financial chicanery occurring. But from what we've seen and what came out during the trial, the money was there to continue this lifestyle that Keith was accustomed to.
Well, I guess what I'm really interested in, if we can get into it briefly, Tony, is I guess Ranieri was also having problems even before Nexium with Consumer Byline, sort of the predecessor. Maybe we could talk just briefly about that and then get into maybe your falling out with Ranieri.
Consumers Byline was 22 attorney generals and two federal agencies came in to say, you know, you're not in compliance with our regulations. And in part, I believe that some of that was just, I don't know, everybody wanted a little piece. It wasn't that it wasn't possible for him to correct those errors or those things that the, from a compliance standpoint, that the different states were asking for. With Keith, the one thing he'll never, ever admit is that he's wrong. So rather than make those minor changes in some cases that would have allowed the company to stay moving, he refused, which any psychopath, what they really enjoy more than anything is the destruction. So watching the company, and I look back now in hindsight and see it, watching the company be destroyed was part of what he enjoyed. And, you know, back to that, the money side of things, there was a lot of money that went through Consumers Byline. And I look back now and I wonder, well, you know, where did all that money go? Because it's probably hidden somewhere. It was a very successful company that had, and it was a business. It was business related. It wasn't a self-help group. So the people that were drawn into it were business, mostly men and women, but not people looking to Keith for how do they make their lives better, but how do they build a better business? And the same people that were there in the early days that helped him to facilitate that lie, that were there during the beginning of ESP, Executive Success Program, which morphed into Nexium and then all of the other things, helped to allow him to do that. Those that lived long enough, you know, that there's two people that passed fairly young that were involved with that inner circle. But, you know, the money was used not only for his lifestyle, but the money was used to keep people, his detractors like myself, at bay and silenced. Because, you know, litigation, if, as long as you don't care what the outcome of a lawsuit is, you can sue someone as much as you want. It takes a lot to get the courts to realize what a litigious lawsuit is, or even the reality that that is what's happening. At the time that Keith was arrested, he was suing me at that point in the state of Washington, and then trying to have me extradited to Mexico on false charges of collusion and coercion and all of that. I don't know. I don't read Spanish and I've never really gotten an actual copy of the charges, but, you know, forum shopping, as they call it, to sue someone across the country. I'm in New York State and that's Washington State. It's just financially, it will destroy you. But when someone sues you, you have to respond. You have to respond to their action, their motion, one way or another. And with the finances of the Brothmans financing all of this, all of these lawsuits, they were able to use that, in my case, to just a constant barrage. And as a warning signal for anyone else that tried to leave, and for anyone else that did leave that spoke out, they received a lot of the same treatment. It was like a playbook in a sense of how they silenced their detractors. They just sued them into bankruptcy.
Well, I believe that Ranieri also threatened you You know, you faced harassment from his sort of subordinates. I believe he even said to you, you know, the last time you spoke to him, he said, you know, the next time I see you, you'll either be dead or in jail. And, I mean, this is a very scary, scary sort of individual, despite his, as you put it, his sort of unassuming demeanor.
Yes. Yes. And especially when you don't, you know, a comment like that coming from someone that was your partner, your lover, your helping you raise your child. I mean, at the point that that statement came out, our relationship was greatly digressed from where it was, because he, in all honesty, he had replaced me. He had replaced me with Nancy. But he doesn't want to replace and have you go away. He wants to replace you and have you stay. And I wasn't comfortable with what I saw going on. I wasn't comfortable with I went to the pilot program, as I call it, of executive success program. And to me, it was therapy, and it was being done in a way that the early days of Collateral, because you had breakout sessions where people shared their secrets, and they were sharing all of these secrets with people that didn't have the ability to be able to help them if they unearthed trauma during this coursework, because they weren't licensed professionals, and be things that they could use later to kind of keep you in check or keep you in line, so that the next time I see you, you'll be dead or in jail comment was his way of letting me know that I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to stop until you either come back, die, or you're in jail. He was kind of right. I mean, the next time I saw him, he was in jail.
Well, Chet, I want to ask you now, what do you think about how Ranieri and Nexium tried to deal with accusations of being a cult? I know Rick Ross went after them, who's a great cult deprogrammer, and he's, you know, they're very litigious. But I guess their sort of go-to to being called a cult was to say, well, we're not a religion, so how could we be a cult? How do you look at Nexium in terms of it being a cult, and how they've tried to brush off those accusations in the past?
Well, we're not a religion, so we can't be a cult line. It's just one of the tactics. It wasn't really something that they used much back when I started reporting on them. When I started reporting on them, they used gaslighting pretty effectively. For example, my first article about Keith and Nexium, I had attempted to contact them to get them on the record, and I never heard back from them until after my article was published. And then once my article was published, then I was contacted by Nancy Saltzman. She admonished me for not trying to get a hold of her, and I clearly had. And at that point, she tried to use all sorts of tactics to win me over, to start getting positive reporting. They didn't like operating above board, I guess is one way to put it. They would never operate with you as a journalist. They would never operate with me as I was accustomed to. You know, you call somebody, you get them on the record. That's kind of what you're used to as a journalist. So the way they behaved while I was reporting on them, and then immediately after my first story came out, really confirmed for me a lot of what I was being told about them, that they were a cult, because they acted in such a bizarre manner, again, using just lies and gaslighting to fight back. It was really bizarre and definitely confirmed it for me. And, you know, as Tony pointed out, they used litigation constantly. They tried suing my newspaper at one point, were unsuccessful because they filed a lawsuit against the wrong corporate entity, which, you know, you'd think with the tens of millions of dollars they had at their disposal, they could have at least fact-checked the organization they were trying to sue. So yeah, they used very bizarre tactics to fight back, and the tactics reaffirmed for most people what they were.
Tony, maybe you could describe some of your experiences with the sort of gaslighting tactics that Ranieri and his followers would use, especially in these letters he would write and other letters that were written by people like Kristen Keefe and others, where, you know, there's these unusual sort of references to John Milton's Paradise Lost. I mean, it's all, it almost feels like something out of a horror movie at times, but it's very real.
Yes, it was very real then, and it's very real today. I mean, the tactics of gaslighting are, the letters that I received when I was leaving Keith, the letters that I received from Nancy Salzman, multiple from Keith, Kristen Keefe, Barbara Jeske, Pam Kayfritz, were, what they do in a gaslighting letter is they take a little bit of what's actually factual, and then they mash it up in a way that is, it's confusing in the sense that you go, well that's true, but I'm not a thief, and I'm not a liar, and I'm not a parasite, and I'm, but they've wrapped it in this vein of information that in effect is factual. And it's, I love you. And then they, I love you, beat you up, and then love you at the end. And it's difficult because the people that are presenting you with these letters or calls or information were at one point your friends. You know, when you leave a cult, when you leave an organization like this, you don't just break up with a boyfriend. I mean, I tried, but it doesn't quite work that way. You lose everything. You lose your friends. You lose what you consider your family, your finances. Your whole existence gets taken away. So you're very much off balance. And then you get hit with these gaslighting letters where they're making accusations against you, and they get you to second guess your past events and make you feel that the things that they're saying, they're justified in, and you're not justified in saying that, you know, you're uncomfortable with the situation or you want to get out of the situation. So it's difficult. And they went as far with me as breaking into my home, stealing my mail. And it took months before I realized that it was a diligent, thank God, neighbor who said, you know, is it okay that the girl with the long blonde hair takes your mail every day? And I said, what are you talking about? And my mom and I put a camera up in the window of a bedroom and filmed her taking the mail. So what she would do is she would take the mail, and I was getting my mail a day late, but I wasn't aware of that. Again, you have to go back in time as to when this was. You paid your bills by writing a check. So they'd open up my credit cards or my electric bill or my car payment or whatever was coming, and they'd cancel them. And you know, your phones are shut off and you're getting these letters telling you how you're destroying your life and the life of your child, and you know, how karmically you're going to pay Milton's and Paradise Lost, where I was Lucifer and he was God and I had taken the fall. But if I could just come back, I would just forgive him. He could fix everything. And when your life is so upside down and everything that you knew, that you thought you knew, was not really what it was, you're in a very, very difficult place to try to center yourself. And I thank God for my parents, because if it were not for them, I don't know what would have happened. You really needed someone that you knew loved you and that you trusted that they knew what was best for you at a time that you didn't know what was best for you. So, you know, I got out because of them. And for people that are listening to this that have children or friends or family involved in an organization like this, the best advice that I can give you is to try to help educate them and be there and love them. Don't criticize, but be there and be open to whatever they need to know that they have a way out, that they're not just trapped where they are. It's a bit of a tough love, but it has to come from a good place of love.
Tony, it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned this concept of the fall, which is one of the modules, I guess, that is taught or was taught in the executive success programs. Maybe you could describe how these modules came about and what the fall is in a little bit more detail. It's quite baffling that you know, Ranieri was able to convince so many people of this. It's sad, though, too, you know. It's difficult to even talk about in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, approximately, they say about 14,000 people went through the curriculum. And I think that if you were an individual that went in and took a 5-day class, and that's what you took and that's what you experienced, you probably got some really good stuff out of it and went on to have a productive life. And that was the end of it. If you took a course or a class away from Albany, I don't think people had the same experiences as they did in Albany, or if you were tapped to come to Albany, that meant, you know, the Vanguard wanted you. And in my opinion, the modules were created by something that Nancy had already created, which is what Keith saw in the first place. Keith watched Nancy do a workshop called Irresistible Communications. And with that, he convinced her that what she had already created, in effect, he had created. Just an amazing talent that he had to take people's, what they had in them and turn it into something that he could only give them. And just repackaged it. And in repackaging that, they created Executive Success Program and modules. And the module, the fall, was to, you had to teach the students how to see what a suppressive was. So what is a suppressive? And it's another term that he stole from Scientology. As one of the witnesses in the trial said, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen to you? And she said, well, I could be called a suppressive. And they said to her, well, what is a suppressive? And she said, an evil, horrible person. And then they asked her, well, can you name a suppressive? And she said, yes, Tony Natale. And then they said, have you ever met Tony Natale? And she said, no, I have not. To the extent that he went to name me as someone that you need to look out for in the world as an evil person, as a suppressive, showed, you know, the level of no one leaves Keith. He doesn't take rejection well at all. So in order to prove that he wasn't infallible, he had to prove that I was horrible.
Because you were the one that was willing to sort of say no to him.
Yes. Yes. At a very early stage. And I think that because in his mind, he gave me a position in his life that he had not done with anyone else. I mean, we lived together in a home. We were raising my child together. And you don't stay with someone for that amount of time because it's all horrible. It wasn't all bad. There were really some wonderful times, and there was some good there, at least I thought, for what I saw that was happening. It was the things that were going on behind my back that I was totally unaware of and didn't learn until years and years later. The young girl that he was molesting and raping at Consumers Byline, and then he would come home and play with my child. That was something that I was totally unaware of. But he was so good at compartmentalizing even his own life that he put on the face that he felt that person needed to see. And when he gave me this, what I needed to stay with him, because we broke up once early, within about 6 months or 8 months into a relationship, something like that, we split up. I said to Amelia, this is great. You know, I'll stay working with your company, but I don't think this relationship's going to work out for me. And he doesn't let go easily. He didn't then either, but said, I'll give you everything you need. I know what you and your son need. And, and I'll provide that for you. And for a short amount of time, he did. And he tried to do that lifestyle until he just couldn't pretend anymore. And he saw a way out. But in seeing that way out, he wanted me still to stay because he felt that I should, you know, at that point they were, you know, you have to call him Vanguard, Tony. I'm like, I'm never going to call him Vanguard. Is that what I should have my son do instead? You know, should he be calling him Vanguard? No. So I think because in his mind, A, no one else has ever left and he doesn't take rejection well. He decided that if he couldn't have me, he was going to destroy me.
Well, it's very telling to me that this idea of the fall, he's essentially saying Tony is the first suppressive. And he's essentially saying that you are Lucifer. I find that very interesting because it's a complete inversion of the reality of it. I mean, you know, if anyone's the monstrous Luciferian character, it's Keith Raniere. Mm-hmm. You were one of the victims of this, and there's other victims as well, and you both get into that in the book.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And I've said this for years. If you want to know what he's thinking, what he's doing, what any type with anyone with a sociopathic personality is doing, look at what they're claiming you're doing, and in fact, that's what they're doing. They hold up a mirror and show you if you're able to look past the pain that they're pointing it at you. It's really what's going on in their minds. And if in the book there's the diagrams in that he wrote me in the, you know, in the sides of the Milton's Paradise Lost, all the horrible things that were going to happen to me in my death timeline. But you know, Keith, it had worked for him before, and he just thought it would work again.
Chet, if I could ask you, you don't really delve into it necessarily in the book, but you've had encounters with a number of the sort of high-ranking people within Nexium. I think it says in the back jacket of the book, actually, that you're the only journalist who played a midnight game of volleyball with actress Allison Mack from Smallville, Seagram heiress Claire Bronfman, and the now notorious Keith Raniere. What did you gain out of those interactions? What insights do you have based on those? Not just of Raniere, but maybe these other people that were involved and sort of how they were taken in by all of this and what your impression of them was.
Sure. So the volleyball game, Claire and Claire did not play. So that's when you read that back to me, it made it sound like Claire maybe was actually played the game and she was not, she didn't play, but she was there. The people that I met, that night at that volleyball game, the people I've met subsequently who were members of Nexium and left, the people who testified, who were members of Nexium, DOS, I liked all of them. I was impressed by most of the people I met. Had I wandered into Nexium's orbit, unprepared, without warning, I could see myself getting caught up with these people. Many of the members of Nexium are beautiful, physically attractive people. They're very funny. I met a lot of, you know, people who had a strong bond with each other. I mean, it seemed like a very fun, tight knit group. You know, there was an a cappella, event even that they hosted that I went to, and it was, you know, had I not been there to investigate this dangerous cult, I might have had fun. You know, I mean, it was everything about it seemed fun, and Allison Mack and Nikki Klein, they they were looking to branch out, and they were looking to branch out into the town I lived in, Troy, New York. And they even started hanging out with some of my personal friends. And my personal friends, you know, these people who are in a close, my close inner circle, they liked Nikki and Allison. And I could, you know, I could see why, you know, everything about the outside trappings of NXIVM are great. And Tony pointed that out. You take a 5-day intensive, take a 12-day intensive, you take any amount of coursework, for the most part, you're not going to be brought into the this sort of inner circle, or even with it, you aren't moved inward. You know what I mean? You're not taken from the outside and moved inward. For the most part, you stay on the periphery. And as long as you stayed in the periphery, you know, you're paying for courses. Maybe they help you, maybe they don't. But for the most part, it seems harmless. And I'm certain that for a large part of the people who went through NXIVM's coursework, the idea that it was a cult, I'm certain to them it seemed ridiculous, like a ridiculous thing.
Well, I was going to add to that real quick. I think mm-hmm. what we're sort of getting at here is there's sort of an outer shell and then a bunch of sort of sub-inner shells to NXIVM. You mentioned DOS, which was mm-hmm. for women. That was the sex slavery aspect. And then there was, I believe, Society of Protectors. And it's very interesting to me because there's a lot of this weird men's rights, quote-unquote, red pill sort of ideology to these, like, sort of NXIVM subgroups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's funny you bring that up. Keith, in some ways, is like the king of the incels, you know, except he's not celibate. He presented himself that way, but it wasn't. So, yeah, there's a lot of red pill. There's a lot of, you know, I think a lot of people look at the Hollywood sex cult and they think, oh, it's a bunch of liberals, you know. But a lot of Keith's ideology is very... online, I guess you could say.
He would fit right in. It's also very influenced by Ayn Rand, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, absolutely influenced by Ayn Rand. You know, I mean, you run into Keith's ideology all the time on like Reddit. You know, there are Reddit subreddits, so you're going to run into Keith's ideology. So there's Keith's ideology is we've seen it. We're seeing it now. He really is the kind of the cult leader of his time. I think to be as successful as Keith was, you have to be sort of of your zeitgeist, and Keith certainly was even at the forefront of this this movement. You know, a lot of that came out, you know, the anti-tax stance, the anti, like, you know, his disbelief in climate change. I mean, basically any sort of like popular red pill or conservative trope right now, you pick it up. Keith probably believed it.
Tony, I'm curious if you could comment a little bit on the ideology of Ranieri, because one of the things I noticed in the book was this whole, he sort of fancies himself a John Galt. He's also extremely anti-government, very paranoid about the government. You know, he's almost like a David Koresh character in some ways.
Yes, David Koresh. Keith did fancy himself as a John Galt and superior to most people and wanting to be a leader of a movement. And convincing people that it was his way or, you know, it was their problem, not his. It was, he was better and smarter than anyone else. And the people, as Chet said, the people that were drawn to NXIVM were really good people. People say to me all the time, oh, these crazy people. I go, no, they weren't crazy people. I don't know that anyone joins a cult. No one joins a cult. But when it's presented to them that you have a man with a 240 IQ and a woman that's in the top of her field in neurolinguistic programming, backed by the heiresses of a liquor fortune, And the Dalai Lama comes in to see them, and they vacation on the island of Richard Branson. There's a lot of trappings there, and Keith built on that. The not paying taxes and hiding from the government came early on in the consumer's byline days. I mean, the government was after him. So his excuse back then was because we were trying to do so much good in the world by saving people money that the government didn't want us to do that. Yeah. All right. So now that I'm fully awake and looking back at the ridiculousness of the statement, but at the time it made sense. And I'm sure with the people that went through coursework with ESP or Nexium, the things that he was saying in some sense made sense. But as Chet pointed out, you took a course or a class or a few of them, and it wasn't until you were drawn in. And then what he started to do was, what I saw was compartmentalizing almost the individuals. So if he found that he had a group that was interested in acting, he created the Source, and that was for actors. And the Society of Protectors was the men's movement, his way of teaching his philosophy on Red Pill. He had Jeunesse for Women, a women's organization created by a man, which should have given someone a heads up, but he had Jeunesse, which was for women. And then there was Rainbow Cultural Gardens, which was his form of Waldorf education, because that's where he was educated. That's where I had my son being educated. And what Keith does is he sees the get in anything. So he tries to pull on that and then pump people into that place where they're going to succeed, because first of all, he has them believe that without him, they can't succeed in that thing that they love so much. So when he finds producers that want that particular, have that particular drive, he almost creates, as you call, a shell around them to be able to give them that.
Real quickly, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I want to comment. You mentioned the term producers, and I completely forgot to bring that up to you. He has this terminology of producers, and then there's parasites. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole, like, all the words he uses and the sort of ideology he creates around this, it's very eerily, I mean, when you're calling people parasites, that's a very, you know, to me, that shades of some very scary ideological movements from the past.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And he would take the producers and convince them that they had parasite tendencies, and they don't want to have parasite tendencies. Everybody wants to be a producer. So it was just, you were almost like a hamster on a wheel with him. It just continued to go and go. And in creating companies that help fulfill your need to produce journalism, he started to realize that people were going to start looking, like on the Rick Ross site. Thank God for Rick Ross. Thank you, Rick Ross. Then people were going to be looking on sites. So what he did was he created a thing called Knife Media. So you got the truth in media through his organization, and yet another multi-level marketing company. So you were surrounding yourself with these, he compartmentalized each person's drive or desires by providing them with a company that fit their modality of what they wanted in the world.
And just to clarify, what did he mean when we're talking about the producers? We sort of know what that means. What does he mean when he says parasites? Because in some of their lingo, they're like, well, parasites aren't necessarily bad people. They can be good people, but they're still parasites. I mean, it's all very odd and awkward.
A parasite is anyone that doesn't really listen to Keith's belief system easily. So if you come along and you follow along, everyone has a moral compass. So you have a line in the sand where you will cross or you won't. And what Keith does with people is he pushes it. He keeps escalating to see how far he can get that individual to go. And in doing so, the term that's used is they have parasitic tendencies, and that's why they're doing that. And then a group of people are sent into EMU and teach you that what you're thinking isn't really right, that you really need to look at it differently. Really, the way he wants it looked at is the way he would like you to see it. So you can have parasitic tendencies, and then he can help you to be a producer.
Chet, maybe we could get into, before wrapping up here, the most egregious crimes and trail of bodies that Nexium have left behind. I believe Ranieri was convicted on 7 different counts. Could you give us a little insight into sort of the crimes of Nexium?
Sure. I mean, there were the crimes that they were convicted of. There are the crimes that they were not convicted of. What they did to Tony, what they did to Rick, numerous other people, and crimes that haven't even really been investigated yet. But the crimes that they were convicted of, that Keith was convicted of, that Nancy and Lauren and Allison and Claire and Kathy all pled guilty to, but the crimes that Keith was convicted of, they ranged. There was but as far as the most egregious crimes, it's just when you're holding up these crimes of keeping a girl trapped in a room, coerced into a room by herself for 2 years, when you're talking about crimes of rape,
human branding,
child abuse, child pornography, the creation of child pornography, what he did to some of these women. I mean, the crimes are so beyond the pale that it's hard to really pick out the most egregious. They're all what Keith's life has been one, like, a continuous assault on vulnerable people. And we know without a shadow of a doubt that these crimes that Keith has been committing go back into the 80s. And the fact that he finally got caught in 2017, you have this long run of crimes against the most vulnerable people in society for decades. So the trial that Tony and I sat through, Keith's trial, that 7 weeks, was a nightmare of one nightmare after another being testified to.
Is it true that I don't mean to interrupt, I just wanted to say,
you're fine.
Is it true that I've heard accounts of what, you know, Nexium members and Nexium survivors looked like at that trial. I mean, I've heard, you know, that there were members that were just gaunt, you know, real thin, you know, just looked completely undernourished. I mean, it sounds like a horror show.
It was the witnesses who testified, you know, what they testified to was truly nightmarish. The what they were put through, even Lauren Saltzman, one of Keith's co-conspirators who has pled guilty and will have to, you know, pay for the crimes she committed. What she was put through was so terrible that it's hard to put it into words, honestly. But it's kind of hard to look at those decades of criminality and draw any real conclusion other than just, you know, disappointment that it wasn't stopped sooner, and frustration and sadness. I mean, it was an anger. I mean, there's so much wrapped up in looking at those crimes.
I believe that Mark Vicente, who was involved with Nexium, he was the director of What the Bleep Do We Know, I believe he cried at that trial and said, you know, this was evil. And, you know, I'm a fairly secular person, so, you know, I I don't like to use the metaphysical idea of evil that much, but I have to agree with him. This just, I mean, if there is evil, it's summed up in this whole case.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. I mean, you watched him in that, at that trial, and you listened to the horrific things that these witnesses testified to, and you watched him in, he was performing. I mean, I really think in his mind, he thought that the jury seeing him each and every day was going to convince them that, of course, he was innocent of these crimes and that all these people were foolish. And it was their, it was them that caused this and not him. And it was a horrible thing to experience and listen to. And for me, the most disturbing, some of the most disturbing things that happened in the trial was the collateral that was used and the proof that was used to prove that he was the exploitation of a child were photographs. So the photographs of the girl that was 15 years old at the time that he took her photos were found in a drive that was hidden on one of his computers. And it was along with a group of other women, all photographed, all in his inner circle, all within the same few months of each other. And when he took the picture for when she was 15, she didn't have any scars on her body. And then she had an appendicitis at 16. So she had the scar from the appendix. And then later when he branded her, and then there's the scar from the brand. And yet he got to watch and look at these photos. And for me, it was almost like it was re-victimizing them all over again, because you could see how much he enjoyed looking at those pictures again, watching the videos of his library per se. And, you know, you go back to the fact that, and that was 2005 was when those photos were taken. If it weren't for the inner circle that were there at that time, that helped to perpetuate that lie and that myth that he was a renunciant. You know, there was people that went through this program that believed that he was a celibate monk while he was having relationships with all of these women, many of them knowing about each other, and a girl that was 15 years old. Yet no one had the fortitude to come forward and say, someone has to stop this.
Tony, I just had two more questions real briefly. I know we're running up on the hour mark, but if you could just answer two more things, would that be okay?
Sure.
I wanted to ask you, what was your experience at trial of seeing Ranieri after all those years? I mean, I'm sure he was, you know, none too happy to see you.
It was very joyful for me. Let's see. Who was it? I sat in the same spot every day, and where I was seated, I could see, I had a clear line of sight to Keith, because that's why I was there, to see him. And in the beginning, he would just glance at me and glare at me, because he wasn't really supposed to be looking around the room in the early days, in the early parts of the hearings and such. But by
I was just going to say real quickly, you know, it's funny. He thought, you know, he would be seeing you.
Yes.
In jail when it was, well, it was him in the end. Yes. So.
Yes, which is why I got so much joy out of it. And I needed to make sure to let him know that I was going to be there each and every day. I didn't miss one second of that trial, not one second. It was part of the healing for me was to go and listen to this. And then part of the horror was to listen, because I know Chet and I have talked about this. I don't think either one of us expected what we heard to unfold in the way that it did. And then to listen to the parallels of what he was doing to whom, while I knew what he was doing to me at the same time, and running these parallel lives where he was creating this illusion of being a renunciant and a deity in a sense, while he was just litigating me to death and then locking a girl into a room and then raping a 15-year-old. It was just beyond. And again, back to the fact that there were at least a handful of people, if not more, that were aware of what was going on. So I think in part, some of the frustration is that not more is being done, at least for me. It's part of the frustration that some people seemingly are just going to be walking away unless the Northern District steps up and does more, because it's a jurisdictional aspect. But it would get to the point where Keith would just glare at me, and he had glasses that were not fitted well because they're prison glasses, and sometimes he would show up without them. I don't know how they disappeared, but he would use his middle finger to push up his glasses while he stared at me. So he was, you know, he was slipping me off. So I would use my middle finger and I would brush back my bangs. This is called matching and mirroring in NLP. So we were having some NLP moments. There was a lot of nonverbal communication going on. And I had someone tell me that at the last hearing he was at, which was, I think, the ninth Curcio hearing that had to be called, he turned and looked back into the spot that I normally sit at. And the person that told me this, he said to me, "I think he was looking for you." Well, his day's done. The next time I see him will be the day he's sentenced.
And the last thing I want to ask you, and I we didn't get to some of the victims that didn't survive, like, and I may be mispronouncing her name, but Barbara Jensk, who, she had brain cancer. And yeah, she was dying. And I'm pointing this out to my listeners. When she was dying, Ranieri, Vanguard, as he likes to think of himself, said she should come up for V-Week and, spend it with us. This will be a great honor for her. Mm-hmm. And she's dying. And they just, it's baffling to me how people like Ranieri think. It's it really is evil. But the last thing I wanted to ask you was about, a figure who comes up in this story that I think is often not talked about, and that's Kristen Snyder. Maybe you could tell my listeners who Kristen Snyder is, and then we can wrap up.
Kristen Snyder was a young woman from Alaska that got involved with Executive Success Program right as it was morphing into NXIVM. And she came to several workshops, came to Albany at a particular time, met with the great and wonderful Vanguard, returned back to Alaska, had what is considered to be a psychotic break or a nervous breakdown in one of the intensives. She was not the first, and I'm sure not the last, and left the workshop, and her body has never been recovered. There was a suicide note that was left, saying that she was sorry that she didn't realize her internal organs or internally she was already gone, and she was sorry to her parents. And it's heartbreaking because one of the long-term goals I hope to have is the amount of coercive control that someone like a Keith Ranieri and Nancy Salzman can inflict on someone that's in a vulnerable state, like a Kristen Snyder, can bring someone to the point where the suicide, who's really responsible? Who's the responsible person for the action if you have taken and manipulated that person to a point where with normal trappings, they wouldn't act or be or present themselves in that way, and that you push them to a point where they're so vulnerable that they think that this is their only way out. And coercive control, gaslighting, the manipulation that goes on within these organizations. And now that we have the internet so pervasive, where trolls and people can go out and seek out people to try to continue that mode, that manipulation, something needs to be done where we kind of hone this in and put the responsibility back on the person that's causing that to happen. And Chris's death is something that when they reached out to me, when the reporter that did the story, Dennis Husko, who was also the person that let me know that Keith was arrested. So, the universe in its full circle. When he reached out to me, when he was doing the story in 2002, it was frightening to me that he was causing and creating that same level of gaslighting and manipulation in someone where he pushed them to the point where you know, that her body has never been found. So that there's a suicide there. There's a loss of life for family and their child. And why is there no responsibility there? There were a lot of people in that intensive. And someone needs to kind of talk about what happened. Yet, as Chet and I say, those are some of the things that we feel people should be held responsible for that so far they have not. But we're not done. You know, we're going to do a podcast and help to kind of expose more of the underbelly of what went on here and what continues to go on, sadly.
Well, I want to thank you, Tony, Natalie, and Chet Hardin, for coming on Parallax Views. I want to give you a chance to plug the book and your future work. And also, I don't know, Tony, if you can... I always say that I like to end the show on a positive note. That's really hard when we're talking about these things. But if you have any, you know, positive vibes we can give out to listeners on how maybe we can force change through when it comes to these issues, please feel free to do so.
Sure. The book is called The Program, Inside the Mind of Keith Raniere and the Rise and Fall of NXIVM. You can get it at any one of your local bookstores, or you can go to our website, which is thefallofnexium.com, and we have links, so you can go to Amazon or wherever you make your purchases. We, in the future, will be doing a podcast called The Fall of NXIVM, and we ask that anyone that's has a story to tell, to please reach out to us. We want to provide a very safe place for people to be able to go and share their experiences, where if they ask us to keep them private, you know, our people that talk to us, that share things with us, some want to go come forward and others don't, but they just need someone to talk to. And from a positive note, I've met some amazing, beautiful people through this, because he doesn't draw bad people. He draws really good people that want to do well in the world. And the sad thing for them is when they are drawn down this road for so long that it takes them years to wake up. But when they do wake up, that beautiful soul is still in there. So it's not all bad. He doesn't draw bad. He draws good. The few that are just as black as his soul, as he is, some of them are being teed up to go to jail, but not enough time will be served. But, you know, it's not my place to make that decision. That's in God's hands. So we'll see.
And Chet, I want to thank you for being a journalist that, you know, covered this case. I think sometimes in our society, we forget to thank the journalists. If there's anything you want to add on a positive note with regards to journalism, where it's headed, or just the NXIVM case and where it has gone, please do so.
Oh, well, thanks, JG. Thanks for having us on. You know, it's the conviction of Keith Raniere, the NXIVM finally being brought down. That's positive. You know, a few years ago, I wouldn't have believed this would ever happen. When I started reporting on NXIVM, they seemed indestructible and invincible, you know, considering the money they had behind them, the political clout they had behind them. So the fact that it can happen was a positive thing for me. And I hope anyone who's listening to this, who's, you know, in a situation that feels impossible, that are in a coercive relationship or an abusive relationship, or being, you know, even if they feel like they have, there's no way out of something, you know, it can change. And we saw it happen. We saw it happen with NXIVM. So, you know, it's odd for someone like myself who's spent so much time investigating, you know, bad guys that and kind of as cynical as that makes you. It was heartening, I guess, is the word, to watch this happen, and gave me some optimism about the power of enough journalists and enough people who are willing to speak up and take the hits. You know, there are people out there who will stand up for what's right. And that's, you know, that's comforting. So,
well, thank you again, Tony and Chet, for coming on Parallax Views. Everyone, please read this book, The Program, Inside the Mind of Keith Raniere and the Rise and Fall of Nexium.
Thanks, JG.
Thank you for having us. We very much appreciate your time.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I know the story of Nexium and its monstrous leader, Keith Raniere, is a difficult one to stomach. But I hope you found something worthwhile, insightful, and maybe even a glimmer of hope in my conversation with Tony Natale and Chet Hardin, authors of the new book, available now from Grand Central Publishing, The Program, Inside the Mind of Keith Raniere and the Rise and Fall of Nexium. I highly recommend checking that book out, folks. Although, as I said, it can be a very tough story to stomach. But these kinds of things need to be exposed. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you're interested in supporting my work, please consider contributing to my Patreon, where you can hear the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.